I've got a couple things I want to talk about this morning. So we're going to ring the singing bowl. We'll do a minute or two of meditation. I'll bring us out of that with a prayer, and we will get going. Lord of the happy, joyous, and free, we thank you for your presence here with us this morning, but especially for the awareness of that presence here over this weekend and at this retreat here in this moment and as we go forward from here throughout our day. We recognize you as our one and only guide here this morning. We'd ask that you would guide our thoughts and our actions and especially our words. We'd ask that this retreat that's brought us closer together, this love, the camaraderie, the friendship, one for each other among this group of men this morning, would fill us with your love. And we'd ask that that love would overflow from us into the lives of our families and friends and co-workers and business associates and community members and AA, and especially those that we will help to find this spiritual way of life. Amen. So I want to touch on a couple of things that we haven't touched on. We touched lightly on the steps 6 and 7, and in the seventh step prayer, we'd ask God to remove everything that stands in the way of our usefulness to God and to others. What stands in the way? And then we leave it up to God. And it's different. I think, you know, it's an individual deal. And I've had to learn some lessons the hard way. And many years ago, I was asked to speak at a conference up in Everett, Washington, which is pretty close to Seattle. And it was a conference that they had up there for many years on Thanksgiving weekend. And I went to the conference, and, you know, I had the kind of the premium, you know, 9:30 a.m. Saturday morning spot. So I was the local speaker, and so there was a lot of people there that I knew. And there was a guy that showed up at the conference that I got sober with, and he actually had more sobriety than I did. In just a few weeks sober, the fellowship hall that I was going to had a picnic, and I went to the picnic, and I was like, God, you know, my sponsor wasn't there. I didn't hardly know anybody, and this guy took me under his wings. Just took me under his wing and just took me around and introduced me to everybody. And And, you know, I was still hurt and still even in withdrawals a little bit, still very uneasy about being around other people. And he used what he knew was a part of me to get me introduced to people. He kept going around, he took me and he just introduced me to everybody. And he said, "Hey, this is Kenny, and he's got 10 days or 12 days or whatever it is, and he's got 10 or 12 days off of heroin." And he was just using that junky pride thing that I brought into the program, you know, like there was something about that I'm so grateful, and I don't even really know when it left, but I'm so grateful that it did. You know, that whole thing that if I can't be the best of the best, I'm going to be the worst of the worst. And I was super successful at doing that. And, and it just went back to even when I was a young kid. I started getting arrested when I was about 13 years old. And when the police would come to the house and come in the house and handcuff me and take me away for something that I'd done, I was in the back seat of the car. I was praying, "God, please allow all the other neighborhood kids to see me." You know, that was the kind of mentality I had. And that unfortunately stuck with me until, you know, a good part of my sobriety. And he was so good. Malcolm was so good to me, and he's so several years later, there I am. I'm in a suit and a tie. And I'm dressed up and my hair's cut and, I've put some weight on, and now I'm the local speaker at the AA convention. And during that same period of time, which was several years, my friend had got worse. And I thought, because he kept getting more tattoos, and he started riding with a motorcycle gang, and then it was a sober, and then he got off into doing this outlaw motorcycle 1% deal, and he was a member of a group that was, you know, this outlaw group of bikers, And I was just, you know, there was a part of me that was thinking in my mind, this arrogant, you know, deal in my mind, that somehow God had rendered me in a way that I could be useful to people. And I was up there speaking, and after I gave my talk, people lined up to thank me, and he was there. And he could see, I think, what was going on, the kind of judgment that was going on in my mind. And he came up to me and he said, got up to there at the front and he said, "You know what, Kenny? I can help people that would never talk to you." And it just took the wind out of me, you know, just completely, because I knew he was right. You know, so, and as soon as he said that, you know, I looked and I saw all the other bikers, guys that he had brought to the convention, and their bikes were all lined up outside. And it was like this incredibly beautiful scene, like incredibly beautiful. And so I wanted to touch on that, because that was for me a real, you know, in AA we're storytellers. And it's easier to get through to somebody when you tell a story about step seven than to tell somebody the nuts and bolts of step seven, that, you know, this is how I was able to humbly deal, and God somehow rendered me in a much different fashion, and I was and this fellow I'm talking about is still sober, still doing the deal. All these years later, he still has more sobriety than I do, and we're just great. I mean, I don't see him often because he goes to some different meetings and lives in a different part of town. But when I see him, And he sees me, it's just magical. You know, we just hug each other because he was there for me in those first early days, and he watched the change, and I watched the direction that he went, and I know he's helping a ton of people, and he knows it's in my heart to help people, and it's just a beautiful thing. And so I thought about that this morning, like we really didn't touch too much on step 6 and 7, and so I wanted to touch on that this morning. The other thing that came to me was, I thought I usually kind of end up these retreats with this, but I wanted to get this out early, and I got some more stuff that will, some kind of exercise stuff we'll do, and some things we're going to do here this morning. But I wanted to talk about step 12. That's really kind of the Sunday topic. And, you know, I've told you about how I was given this introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've had a chance to the amazing opportunity to speak to thousands and thousands of alcoholics and share my story and carry the message, and I've had a chance. I don't know how many people I've sponsored, but when I was in early sobriety, I was coming back from a meeting one night, and I can remember it like it was yesterday. I was coming back from a meeting, headed back down to the car lot after a late night meeting, and I just had this shiver kind of come over me, just a whew. And it was just, man, is it good to be alive. Just that, God dang, it's good to be alive. And I hadn't felt that in a long, long time. And so when they told me that in order to keep what I had received, I had to give it away, I believed them. Absolutely. And it just was like, I knew that I needed to reach my hand out to a still suffering alcoholic. And I knew I had to turn into a man with a real answer and reach out and start helping people along the way and helping them through the steps. And that was before I was a year sober. I'm still in touch with he wasn't the first guy I ever sponsored, but he was the first guy I ever sponsored that made it all the way through the steps with me. And he unfortunately didn't stay sober this whole time. He's got maybe I think he's got 3 years or so, but he's a part of our group in Seattle, our group, and we, the group that meets once a month. And he was the first guy I ever got all the way through the steps. And I know I was, you know, I think back on it, I think, God, the puke was hardly dry on my shoes, and here I am trying to help this guy. But that's, you know, that's an incredibly sweet deal too, that I've got these kind of guys in my life. And so I think, you know, for the last 33 years that I kind of think about it in terms of the fifth step. You know, how many fifth steps have I heard? And I think it's been a couple a month for 33 years, so it's a large number. At least that many, you know, of guys. And I've just, and it's not an attribute. I'm not saying this as, it's because it's not an attribute. It's just a gift that from that day that I started sponsoring my first guy to this, I have never in that time had any time that I wasn't sponsoring guys and people weren't knocking on my door asking for help and coming and allowing me to sit down with the big book and take them through the steps. And so it's been a continuous path, and it's just been such a blessing, and I can't imagine my life without it. I've had, and you know, I certainly haven't been a perfect sponsor, and I've learned some hard lessons along the way. That I had a guy, his name was Gary, and Gary came to me. He was an amazing, amazing guy. Just one of these people that you would absolutely love, drunk or sober. You know, he was one of those kind of guys. He was just over the top, and he was a storyteller, and he was really kind of, you know, he was a New Yorker, so he's big on the hands and his accent, and he was a car salesman, had the big diamond rings and the bracelets, and, you know, he was just a flashy guy, and he would tell these stories that were so hysterical, and you knew half of them weren't even close to the truth, but that's just the way it was, and so you just loved the guy because he was just such a character, but he had a really tough time staying sober, and he came to me and asked me to sponsor him, and we were going through the steps, and I was back and forth to Alaska for my job at the time, and he was at my place, and it was the first sober place that I lived, the first place I moved into after I left the car lot, and he was over, and we were doing some work, and he was just telling me, I don't think I'm gonna make it, dude. I don't think I'm going to make it. And he was like, I mean, I'm thinking about this. I can't get the idea out of my mind. I don't know that I'm in trouble here. And so I gave him a couple things to do and said, here, Gary, just do this. And I'm going to go up to Alaska. I'll be gone 4 or 5 days. I'll come back and we'll jump right back into the work as soon as I get back. And, you know, I don't know what page in the book we were on. And he looks over on the table. There was a set of Joe and Charlie tapes. You guys know the Joe and Charlie 12-step awakening, I think they called their weekend workshops they used to do, and they were fabulous stuff, you know, just really excellent stuff. But somebody had given me this set of cassette tapes, you know, from their Joe and Charlie weekend. And he sees those over on the table, and he says, oh, man, maybe can I take those tapes? Can I take those tapes and while you're gone, I'll listen to those? And I know what happens to when you loan tapes out and when you loan books out and stuff. You know, you don't ever see them again. And so I told him, well, listen, my rule is I want to dub those tapes. When next time you come over, I'll dub a set of these tapes for you. And I'll get you a whole set. We'll sit there and, you know, That was how we copied stuff back in those days. And so we'll dub a set of tapes for you, and I'll get you a set of tapes and just, you know, get to the meetings. And I left for Alaska, and I thought about him a lot when I was gone, and I came back, and I called his number, and nobody answered, and I left a message, and I didn't know it, but he was already dead. And he had torn all the furniture, went completely crazy on a you know, binge, and got violent, and the police came, and the police kicked in his door, and he was coming out of the bathroom when they kicked in the door. He was coming out of the bathroom, projectile vomiting out of the bathroom, and fell dead of a heart attack. And they couldn't revive him. And I went home, and that set of tapes was on my table. And I'd listened to that set of tapes. And they would like to have choked me, those goddamn tapes. I didn't want to touch them. I didn't want nothing to do with them. I didn't want anybody to find out that I had them and that he'd asked me for those tapes and that I'd told him no. I made my amends at his funeral service, and I heard his voice just like he was right there with me, just that New York kind of whole thing that, hey, man, I'm in a better place and things are good. And he asked me to, you know, to look after his girlfriend, and I sponsored her for a period of time, And she's still kind of around once in a while in the program, and still has her struggles. But I did everything that he'd asked me to do. I made the best amends I could, and you know, books and tapes and stuff kind of fly out of my house ever since. You know, I mean, I don't hang on to stuff like that. And you know, I give, if somebody comes, something comes to me and I read it and somebody wants it, I give it to them. And I ask people, you know, if you would bring that back, that would be great. But I know that in most cases, I'll never see it again. And it's just fine with me. And I, you know, I sponsored a guy that, you know, I've sponsored several people that have committed suicide in the process of going through the steps with them. They couldn't bear it, and they took their life. And one guy in particular was my friend Brad, and he was a really amazing guy. We'd asked him to speak at Magnolia speaker meeting, and this was many years ago, before it was even way before it was my home group. But I had a connection there, and I'd asked, "Oh, Brad would be pretty good to get him." But he was a real foul mouthed guy, and at my home group, we ask if you take the podium that you keep your language clean as you can. We're not too hard over on it, but we ask that you keep it clean. And the reason that we do that is because there's a lot of people like me. When I was growing up, and the F-bomb started flying, and people were starting to use that kind of language, it meant violence was coming. And in many cases, you know, this kind of profane language is the language of violence. And people don't even realize it. People just use the F-bomb every other word, and they're using that, and it's in meetings and stuff, but it tenses people up, people. Okay, I'm ready. I know what's coming. And so we ask people that they don't do that, and that's been a history in that group for a long time. And old Brad came to the meeting, and we explained everything to him, and there was always the old ladies, first couple of rows were these old ladies with lots of sobriety and very proper, didn't want anybody swearing from the stage. And we told him many times, and the first thing he gets is he gets up there, and he starts telling this joke, and I don't even remember how the joke went. But the punchline was the punchline was how badly his balls got burned in the sand when he was doing this thing, and that was the whole punchline. That's what he started with, and then we asked that you know it's an Alcoholics Anonymous. Keep your talk primarily to alcohol. And he was talking about how he was shooting drugs in there, and he was shooting the drugs in here, and it was coming out this other hole, and he's trying to catch it in his mouth, and these people were just, this was 25 years ago in AA. These people were just shocked, you know. But Brad did really good for a while, and then I just ran into him, and he was one of those guys that was, I ran into him at a little store. He was coming out of a store. And it was just like, I was talking to a total stranger, this guy that had been through the steps and sponsored other people and just started fading away. It was like I was talking to a total stranger, and he said, "Oh man, come on out to my car. I got something I want to show you." And he had go out to his car, and he pulls out this goddamn huge pistol that he just got. And he's showing that to me like it, and I'm just like, you know, he's totally lost all connection with any type of spirituality. I mean, the guy was totally asleep, and it was just a few weeks after that I'd heard that he'd shot himself, probably with that gun that he showed me. And then I sponsored his son after that. His son wanted to get sober, and I sponsored his son. I wanted to keep this. I thought we'd do something real upbeat here this Sunday morning, but I sponsored his son, and this is just the way it is. And this hasn't. I've had a We've got so many people, and I'm going to talk about some of the guys that and the men and women both that I've sponsored that are just so close to my heart. But this is just, I just wanted to put this out there that, man, you know, this is not for the faint of heart. You know, you've got to be spiritually prepared if you go into doing this work, because there are these tragedies. And when I sponsored his son jumped out the window and killed himself on Christmas Day in front of his friends, in front of his children, after he destroyed the Christmas tree and you know, the cops had been called, and he'd you know, we see this kind of stuff, and it's not unusual in our group that, you know, we lose somebody else nowadays with the way, you know, young people are, the kinds of drugs they're using, and it's you know, it's not unusual at all anymore to go to your home group and just hear that we've lost another one. I was at a retreat like this, and it was a retreat that I kind of had maybe Pacey's position in the retreat or Rick's position in the retreat. And I was the behind-the-scenes guy, and we had a treasurer that I worked with. And we put on this retreat every September outside of Seattle. We did it for many years. And we had a gal there from Colorado that was doing the retreat. She was the retreat leader. It was a mixed group, mixed retreat. And a woman showed up at that meeting. Her name was Darlene. And I'd known her because she was kind of connected to this family that I just told you about, to the Brad and the deal and Gary and his girlfriend. She was part of that group. So I knew her. But she showed up to the retreat. She just heard about it somewhere. I still don't know where, but she heard about the retreat. She shows up. You know, she hadn't registered. She hadn't paid. Our retreat was an untaped retreat, and she'd brought a little miniature, one of these little miniature tape recorders with her, and she was trying to sit real close to this gal who was doing the retreat, and trying to record stuff. And then she was just being real inappropriate, and she was crying, and she had lost her teeth somewhere, couldn't find her teeth, and, you know, she was having a psychotic break. And so we, you know, being the person, everybody came to me, hey, what are we going to do? And so I said, well, I'll talk to her at the break, but we're going to let her stay. We're going to find her a bed, we're going to let her stay, and we're just going to remind her that she can't record everything and that she can't interrupt, and she's going to stay for the retreat. So I'm outside the door at the break, and I told Darlene, I need to talk to you, and I start talking to her, and she just grabs me by the lapels like this, just grabs me right by the collar. And she just is looking at me saying, I need some help. You know, I need some help. I am really, really having a hard time here. I need some help. And I was there, and I'm looking over past her and telling and looking over past her, I'm looking for somebody that can help her. I'm thinking, well, certainly there's somebody here that can help you. She's got me by the collar. I'm thinking, there's certainly somebody that can help you. Standing next to me was my wife, Shannon, who's just an amazing, amazing woman, and I hope you can all get to meet her. She's a member of AA and been sober 27 years, and she's a really remarkable, remarkable woman. And she could see the selfishness going on in my head, and she turned and said, Kenny, you have to help this woman. So, knowing how to preserve my relationship, I said, I told Darlene that, Darlene, I'm going to help you, and we're gonna get you settled in, and we're going to keep you here. We're going to have the weekend. And she participated that weekend and still was having a psychotic break. She ended up in the hospital. We got her into a hospital where they checked her in, and she was there a good long time, and several weeks at the psychiatric ward. And she would call me, and I just did what I did with all the people that I sponsored. She'd call, and I would read the book to her. And she had her big book, and she would highlight and underline, and I would talk to her on the phone. She's on the payphone at the psychiatric ward. And we got to the third step prayer, and we did the third step prayer together on the phone. And she started coming out of it, and her mind started clearing. And we got her out, and a good, wonderful group of AA people helped to get her into an apartment. And she had a son. She got reunited with her son, and came to, and she just absolutely lit up the AA scene. I mean, she was one of these people that there's a way of thinking that says the more humble you become, the brighter the flame burns. That's the way it works in spirituality, in the spiritual world. You know, it's not the people that necessarily, but that she was just this incredibly gifted human being with helping others. And she, even today, I can look at all of the people and think, oh, that woman was sponsored by that woman. And they don't even know it, but I know it, what the connection was. And that person was sponsored by Darlene. And I was her sponsor for 7 years. And her son was 7 years old when I first met him, and we got him into that apartment. And his dad had died of a heroin overdose 2 months before I met him. And so we started doing stuff together. I just thought, well, maybe there's more to this sponsorship, and maybe I should step in here. And I started taking him to baseball games, to Mariners games, and eventually they became family. And they were, for every Thanksgiving, every Christmas, every holiday, they were with us. And without missing any. And my family would come. My family got, accepted them, and they were family. And what a lot of people didn't know, because she just didn't talk about it that much, because she felt like the disease that she should be concerned with was alcoholism, and that was her words. She had HIV, and when it was when it was a serious back when it was a serious serious epidemic that was killing a lot of people, and a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew she was sick. And she started taking in people into this little apartment. She started taking in people. She wanted to start a treatment center, but she couldn't wait to get everything done. She just started it right there in her little apartment. And there was always somebody on the couch. And she just fell in love with these the heroin addicts for whatever reason. That was her deal, helping these addicts. And there was always somebody kicking heroin, and she would have a whole group. She had a whole call list, and she would make sure that if you were there, that you had somebody that was sitting next to your bed from midnight till 4 in the morning, from 4 in the morning till 8 in the morning, 8 in the morning till noon. She would call me up and say, okay, we got a kick, can you do a shift? And I'd, sure, I'll come over. And people would come and do shifts there just to be close to Darlene. They just wanted to be in her presence. And And getting any amount of time with her, she was like an angel. And I knew, and she never made a big deal out of it, but I knew that she had a whole system. She would, once you were in there, there was only one way at Darlene's place, and that was cold turkey. There was no drugs. And she was just, we're not doing anything. You know, dude, you are going through this, and we're going to be here with you, and you're going to go through this, and we're going to get you clean. That was her deal. And on the first day, the first person that came over, she would get all their wallet and all their stuff, go through all their stuff, and she in front of them, she would like hand me all the guys' wallets and stuff and say, here's all of his stuff, and I'm sending him away, and he's not bringing your car keys, your wallet, and he's not coming back until Friday next week. So don't you come back here with his stuff until then. And then, so he knew he was like there without his stuff. And I still know several people that got clean and sober on that couch. And you know, the funniest thing is they say it was the easiest kick they ever had. Because she was with them, and she had a deal, okay, the second day you would have to, by the third day you'd have to shave and have to take a shower, and she would give you some clean clothes, and you know, all of these things that she would do. And I knew that she didn't feel like getting out of bed in the morning because she was sick. And I knew that she was, on those days, getting out of bed and doing other people's laundry and cooking the food for other people when she was sick and couldn't eat herself. And to tell you how amazing the transformational nature of Alcoholics Anonymous is, phenomenal. The men in this room, the stories they have, you know, you couldn't fathom the stories that people have, because when you look at them, it doesn't look like that. And the change in her was so dramatic, and there was so much demand on her time, and people vying to try to get a few hours over at Darlene's and to get signed up to, so they could be in her presence and be with her, because she would just lay her hand on your leg and say, and she would just say, "Oh, honey, God is real. Just." And the change was so dramatic that my wife, Shannon, asked Darlene to be her sponsor because she wanted to find out how this transformation was possible and wanted to go through the steps with Darlene. That's a miracle, man. And then I noticed that Darlene was, she took a couple falls that were not ordinary. And so Darlene, I think we need to get you over to the doctor right away. And we got her into the hospital, and she developed full blown AIDS, and there was a brain infection that AIDS patients would get back in those days. But, I remember when the doctor came in and told me that, and this is the miracle, is that she came to us and said, "If anything happens to me, Jake loves Kenny," because we did all kinds of stuff. I would drive him to school some mornings before work, and I'd take him to games, and I'd pick him up after school, and we'd go out to eat dinner, and you know, and I remembered when the doctor came in and said to me, and she had said, "If anything happens to me, would you and Shannon take my son?" And we said, "Yeah, we'd be honored to do that." Not really in our minds thinking that the day would come, you know, you know, I was on her power of attorney and then when the doctor came and he said, "Listen, this is full-blown AIDS, And this is the brain infection. And there's probably somebody in the room that people that know what it was. I can't remember the name, but this is the infection. And it's not 99.9%. This is 100%. There's nothing we can do about this. And there's never been a single case that's lived through this. So we knew that she was gone. There's prior to becoming a big political entity, and I'm not going there in the least, but Darlene just loved Marianne Williamson. She was take, you know, dubbing the tapes, and she would hand them out. And Marianne Williamson, you know, who wrote A Return to Love, which I think is, you know, a spiritual masterpiece by itself. But she just absolutely loved it. And Marianne has a meditation for everything you can imagine. You know, if you've been a victim of abuse, she's got a meditation tape for that. If you have a problem with anger, she's got a meditation tape for that. If you've got sex problems, she's got a meditation. If you're having problems in your marriage, she's got taped. And so Darlene had all the tapes, and everybody that would come over, she was always, oh, here's, listen to this, handing out these Marianne Williamson tapes. And so I knew that Marianne was a big fundraiser and for, you know, the treatment of AIDS patients and AIDS research, and I was able to get a hold of her, and I get a hold of a church that she was connected with in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and I left a message to the church, and I explained what Darlene's situation was, that there was this angel of mercy that lived in Seattle that took in these drug addicts and alcoholics and got them clean and sober and helped hundreds of people, and would you be willing to call? And I get a call. And for those of you that know, you mean you've, most people now have heard because she's on the news and stuff, but in that day she wasn't as prominent as she is now, but the she was still a very, very famous author in the spiritual world. She was in the spiritual movement. She was big, and I get this call, and she's got this Midwestern. It's unmistakable. This angelic Midwestern voice that she uses when she does these meditations. It's absolutely unmistakable. She calls, Kenny. This is Marianne Williamson, and I'm interested in talking with Darlene. And so I said, well, we'll be at the hospital on this day. And she said, okay, well, I'll call your number at that time on that day. And I got Jake, and we went to the hospital. And at this time, he was living with us. And every morning we'd go, wake up, go to the hospital, visit his mom. I'd take him to school. He'd go to school. And I will say this, that he went to we put him in a school that it was a school where they have a whole different idea of education based on kind of the Sudbury Valley methods, they find out, like, what are you interested in? And then, okay, you're interested in movies, then we're going to teach you about that. You're interested in science? Well, we're going to teach you about that. And they, so he went to a school like that, and it was great because, you know, it's that intuitive thought, the inspiration. I knew that if we put him in a public school, he was going to fail. I knew it. So we had a great school that was safe. I'd drop him off there, pick him up. I'd go to work, and then I'd work, and I'd pick him up from school. And then we'd go back down to the hospital and spend our evenings there. And most of our AA meetings were in the chapel of the hospital. And there were so many people coming to visit her that people, they were like telling us. One of the nurses asked me one time, is she like a rock star or something? Because one of the things about Darlene is she had this affinity for the more tattoos and ear piercings and the better she liked you and the more that she wanted you to come be with. And I had to tell her a few times, Darlene, you know, you got to stop falling in love with these heroin addict guys, you know. They're, because, you know, like anybody, you know, she just, but that's the kind of people that loved her the most and that she helped the most. And so there was all these people, and this nurse is like, is she a rock star or something? And I was like, oh, yeah, man, I assure you she is. And she's sure a rock star. And but I got to the hospital, and my phone rang. And, hi, Kenny, this is Marianne Williamson. And I'm like, oh, Marianne Williamson, we just love you so much. And thank you so much for doing this. And let me tell you a little story. Let me tell you about this. And she stopped and said, Kenny, I would like to talk to Darlene. So I went in, and I told Marianne Williamson, this is probably, you're speaking to the biggest black market purveyor of your printed material and your seeing that's anywhere in the world. And she loved it. And so I gave the phone to Darlene, and Darlene just heard that voice, and Marianne Williamson said a prayer over her. You know, just beautiful. Just said, you're going to imagine yourself in this golden ball of light. We were listening, a few of us, over the deal, and her son Jake was with us. When she passed, there were a couple of really remarkable things that happened. One is that I was with her, and I was holding her hand. Her son was holding her other hand. And in those 7 years, she'd become, you know, one of my best friends. And I never had really gotten to that level. I mean, she knew everything about me, and I knew everything about her. That we shared inventories. You know, I took my things to her, you know, when I had stuff. And I have some liver issues, still do, and I had some, it got a little serious at one point in that, even that many years ago, and I was in the hospital, and they'd give me a biopsy, which kind of hurts, you know, because they stick a big needle in through your ribs and poke you and get into your liver and take a little sample. But I came out of that experience, and I came out, and the lady asked me, I was laying on my side on a towel, you know, and the lady asked me, how you doing? I said, oh, I'm doing good. She says, well, how much pain are you in? Are you in any pain? Are you experiencing any pain? And I don't know why, but I told her, I mean, I was in no pain at all. I had just come out. I mean, I was all still doped up on all the stuff. I said, oh, yeah, I got pretty considerable pain going on here. And she says, well, geez, you shouldn't be feeling any pain. I'm only asking you that to make sure that everything's all right. She says, she's looking at the charts. You got quite a bit on board here, fella, and you know, you're probably going to be okay. So they moved me up to my room, and then the nurse comes back in. How much pain are you in from a 1 to a 10? Oh, probably a 15, you know, to honor. I'm not feeling any pain at all. This is just coming out of me, and it's scaring me. And this lady says, well, I'll talk to the doctor. They said, well, listen, we can give you a couple pills to take home, but this pain is going to, that you're experiencing, it's going to subside pretty quick. We'll give you a couple of pain medicines to, a couple of pills to take home, but that's about all the doctor really thinks you need. And if you're in more pain than that, you got to let us know, because it means that something's wrong. You know, we'll have to go back and check you out. So I didn't want that. So I was like, well, all right. And then I asked her the next question. My wife is out shopping. They're going to call her when I'm ready to go. They asked her the next question. They said, "Is there a pharmacy here in this hospital?" I'm thinking, like, how quick can I get this thing filled? This is how dangerous this is. I mean, I'm sober. I'm doing good. I've been through these kind of things before with no problems at all, and this just hits me like the the guy walking into the bar and thinking, you know, maybe a highball with dinner would be fine. You know, it was that kind of thinking. And then the nurse says, yeah, there's a pharmacy. She's looking at me kind of weird. And there's a pharmacy. Is there anybody here with you, you know, that I could talk to? And I said, well, my wife will be back in a little bit. But, and then I asked her the next question. I says, would you be willing to take this prescription down to the pharmacy and fill this thing for me? I told her. But the whole reason this ties into this story, I don't know why I went that far down that path, but the reason that ties into this story is I picked up the phone and called Darlene. And I said, man, Darlene, man, I just asked this lady to go down and try to fill a prescription for me. I'm in no pain. I'm telling her I'm in pain. And, you know, I had that moment of clarity. And then my wife came in, and the nurse is like, oh, is this your wife? Ma'am, come here for a minute. You know, and walked her out and said, I don't know what's going on with this guy, but something might be wrong with this man. And Darlene's, I could just hear her voice, oh, 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 honey, the phenomenon of craving, oh, 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 you're going to be fine. You just don't you dare, if you touch that prescription, you'll have to answer to me. And that's the kind of relationship we had. And when I was there with her and holding her hand, there was nothing between us except for the love of one alcoholic for another. And I got to be open to having a relationship with women in my life today that is like that. There was no connection there at all. And I loved her with every ounce of my being, the way I love my mother and my sister and my daughter and my wife. I loved Darlene that way. And I walked into that room with a boy that was going to say, he's 15 then. He'd been in my life since he was 7. I walked into that room with a young man to say goodbye to his mother. And I walked out of that room with my son, Jake. And Jake is going to pick Glenn and I up at the airport tonight. He's 36 years old, and he's as fine a young man as you can ever imagine. And the reason I one of the things that I wanted to tell you about that story is that was a 12-step call that I wanted to give to somebody else. I almost passed on that whole experience because, oh man, you're a bit much for me. You know, this is going to be a lot of work. We've had such a great time. You know, There was some concern. I have a daughter that's a few years younger, and we're bringing in this older boy. But they just, you know, he was the comedian, and she was the one person audience for everything. You know, he would because he could get away with stuff. He could get away with saying stuff that she couldn't. You know, in some respects, and she would say, oh, I'm going to get up and go get a glass of water. And he would say, yeah, well, why don't you get a big glass of, who gives a shit while you're there? And she would laugh and laugh and laugh. Oh, ho, ho, because he'd swore in front of his parents. And then he'd say, like, hey, how many pancakes do you think I can stuff in my face at one time? How many of these pancakes do you think I can get in one bite, you know? And he'd have like a stack of 5 or 6. And I'd say, Jake, come on now. We're trying to have a family meal here, and my wife would say, No, I want to see this, you know. I want to see this. And they'd laugh and laugh. And I love to go to Mariners baseball games, and it's just been something I found in sobriety. You know, I found this love of baseball. I got sober in 1989, and in 1990, a young 19-year-old kid was signed by the Seattle Mariners by the name of Ken Griffey Jr. And I started going down and watching these baseball games. I just love it. You know, I take the guys I sponsor. We go to games. We sit. And with baseball, now they've sped the game up, so I'm still trying to get. But you know, you can have a conversation, and I could tell this story of Darlene to my guy I'm sponsoring while the game's going on, and we don't miss anything, you know. Might have to stop a few times, but I love the whole pace of it. I love just going and just sitting, and I'm not claiming that's meditation time, but it's kind of a meditative practice in some ways for me. But I like to go early to the game. I like to get down there and figure out where I'm going to park. And stadium opens 2 hours before the game. I like to go down and walk around, see batting practice, and go early. So I'm always like, okay, you know, is everybody going to be ready to go? You got your get your glove, get all the stuff. We're heading down. Let's go. And my son did say things like the night before, he'd say, and immediately he started calling me his dad. And, you know, we had conversations that I was able to just sit down with him because of you. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been able to sit down with him and have these conversations that right away I was able to say, hey, listen, I don't blame you if you throw your whole life away. I won't love you an ounce less if that's the direction you go. But I know your dad died of a heroin overdose and your mom is now passed. But for some reason, God has brought the two of us together, and I've never had a son. So that's the relationship the way that I see it. You know, I'm your father and you're my son. And so if you want to throw your life away, that'd be your decision. But I'm not going to let that happen. So what is it that we want? What is it that we need to get clear here? What is it that we need to do? But he knows, you know, how kind of tight I am with getting down to the game. And he'd say things like, hey, how long do you think it's going to take us to get to the game tomorrow? And he'd be looking at my wife, my daughter, and kind of watch this, you know. How long do you think it's going to take us to get to the game tomorrow? Oh, I don't know, probably 30, 40 minutes drive down there. And then he'd say, well, maybe we ought to make a dry run down there right now and just kind of time it out, you know. You know, he has that kind of sense of humor and that banter that was just such a welcome deal in our family. And Ray, I just loved the story last night because it was that same story repeated that I just told. I was just thinking, oh my God, man. And I think there's other people that have had that same thing that, you know, that's why when we did our little exercise yesterday and I shared with the guys in the group, you know, one of the things I had is my home is still open. You know, my wife and I are not going to have any more children but my home is open if God's children need a place, and you know, I would do it all over again today. With that, it's a little after 10, so we'll call it 10:10. Let's get back in the room by 10:25, and we'll have our last session. Everybody can go. I know people got their coffee in them. People need to go use the restroom and do some things. And we'll come back in. We're going to have another session, and we're going to do a special piece on the prodigal son when we get back. Thanks.